Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 208 for August 30th, 2013. GM has big plans for its truck business. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Peter DeLorenzo.
Man, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. Boy, it seems like it's forever I haven't been here.
I know.
It's good to be back.
You've been gone and back and gone and back, but never here.
That's right. And we got Gary Vasilash with us again.
John, how are you?
Peter. Good. From Automotive Design and Production Magazine. Good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
So I'm dying to ask you guys about this Carlos Tavares thing that's been going on at Renault this week. You know, the chief operating officer of the company.
That's the interview with our former colleague, David Welch.
At Bloomberg.
At Bloomberg, and proceeds to, you know, launch a thought balloon in the blogosphere saying, well, you know, yeah, I would like to run Ford at General Motors. And it's the damnest thing I've ever seen.
I've never seen it. And he tried to make it sound logical, like, look, I really want to run a car company. I'm very passionate about it. And my boss, Carlos Ghosn, is going to be around.
Yeah, Carlos is 59. He's 55.
Yeah.
And so he probably is doing the math, and he figures,
yeah, but does he think Carlos is going to just say, yeah, okay, that's fine. No. He left today.
Well, he didn't leave. He was told he was leaving.
Yes, mm-hmm. He was told.
Because Nissan's got a big event in California this week. They called Nissan 360, where they're showing all their products from all over the world, and Ghosn was supposed to be there yesterday.
Isn't it there like 3 weeks or like wave after wave?
Wave after wave of journalists from all over the world. But, Ghosn was supposed to be there. And then they said, oh, he got called away unexpectedly. Well, now we know why.
Yeah, because now he has the COO job until he fills it, because he said he'll be taking that job over.
That's right.
In the interim. But then, you know, you got to wonder, okay, is it because of that interview with Bloomberg, or was it something else?
Or something else?
Because let's face it, I mean, you got to believe that being at Renault, it's got to be pretty damn tough, and has been for a number of years looking at the European market. And he just might have finally said, you know what? I've had enough of this stuff, and I've been thinking about, you know, my job, my career path. You know, I'm going to go do something else, and who knows? Maybe he'll end up at a place like Lindy, like
That guy's name?
Reitzel.
Reitzel, right? Yeah.
You know, just do something and completely.
Well, he knew what he was doing.
He knew exactly what he was doing.
And I think Carlos just said, okay.
Here's my thinking. I think you're right, Gary. I think he was like, oh, my God, this European situation, you know, especially for Renault, this isn't going to be good anytime soon.
Right.
And I want to run a car company, and I'm not going to because Carlos isn't that much older than I am.
Sure.
So why don't I invite Bloomberg in and raise this thought balloon, as you put it, Peter, knowing full well he's going to get dumped. Right? But now every car company in the business knows Carlos Tavares is available. And all the feedback I've gotten on this guy is he's a damn good executive. He did terrific over here in the Americas. He's moved the needle for Renault. Plus, remember, you know, whenever you leave a car company at that level, senior management, you usually have to agree to a one-year non-compete clause. Well, it's going to be about a year from now, right, when maybe GM or Ford think, hey, it's time to do the CEO change. So my thinking is Tavares knew all along. I'm going to be free and clear. I'm going to let everybody know I'm available. We'll see if it works, though.
But Peter, do you think from a messaging point of view that if there's an executive that's working for your company who goes off the reservation and says something like that, okay, that is the sort of person someone else would want in their company?
No.
So how's that going to work out?
Yeah, well, it may not, you know. I mean, Captain Queeg's going to leave next May, and I think it's going to be an internal candidate. I really do. But, yeah, you bring up a very good point. I mean, it's going to make a company think long and hard. Well, is this guy for real? Is he just going to come and visit us for a few years and then do something like this again? Or?
Well, he wouldn't have a chance at Ford, would he?
No.
Becoming CEO. I mean, that's a done deal, right? It's Mark Field.
Yeah.
GM is a bit more of a jump ball, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I still think Mark Royce is going to be the guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's too many people on the board who understand that they need that continuity, and Mark's a bright guy and the product guy. And I think it's just he's the guy who has to be, mm-hmm. who gets the job. So,
Tavares, you think, is going to end up at some supplier
maybe
company?
He'll run Hyundai.
Hyundai in Korea.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't come run Hyundai here.
No.
He wants the top job. I don't think the Koreans would do that.
I don't think the Koreans would do that. No. And I don't think Kraftchek's going anywhere, at least not that I'm aware of.
Right.
They could go to work for Jaguar Land Rover.
That's right. They're looking for somebody new, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very interesting.
There are lots of opportunities, but again, I mean, the whole supplier thing, I mean, maybe the guy's saying, you know what, you know, because what is it, 62 is the retirement age in France? He's 55, 7 years. Build up a nice stock of money from the supplier that wants to pay him lots of dough. That might not be a bad move.
But, hey, the other half of Renault-Nissan made big news this week, too. Nissan coming out saying that it's going to have an autonomous car by 2020. What do you guys read of that?
And didn't GM jump in and say they're going to do...
Well, careful. GM said that they're going to have something called Super Cruise, which is really semi-autonomous. That's like adaptive cruise control with some amount of steering to it. Not quite as bold
well,
as
but
what
I mean
Nissan
you can said. Buy you can buy an Acura RLX or a Mercedes S-Class right now and basically have that very same capability of the, you know, the cruise and the steering. I mean, it's there. But you know, the thing that strikes me, if you think about that, I mean, you know, you guys have been in autonomous cars, and you know, and it strikes me that the interior architecture of cars is not designed for autonomous driving. I mean, why the hell do you want to sit there with this damn steering wheel in front of you and, you know, you really can't do anything, and it's not all that comfortable with that situation. So it's not like, you know, you're sitting back and, you know, like in a Barca lounger enjoying a you know, fine glass of wine while you're reading the newspaper. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, you know... First, we don't have any autonomous cars yet, so everything's got to be engineered to whatever is on the road today. And no one is going to just say, oh, yeah, I'm going to totally trust this autonomous technology. Certainly, even if you do, your insurance company is not.
Sure.
And the car companies that are building these things do not. So we're going to go through a multi-decade transition mm-hmm. into these autonomous cars. But I see... somewhere out 2030, 2040, yeah, I think you will be able to buy cars with no steering wheel, no gas or brake pedal, no gear shift, none of that stuff.
It's called a bus.
But, yeah, I think that'll be one of the transformative things about autonomous cars is we'll completely reconfigure the interior of a vehicle. In fact, I keep saying I think we'll go back to the great Coachworks builders. I think you'll see a revival of them because not only will you not have to have all these apparatuses to drive the vehicle, presumably once you get down the road far enough where everything's autonomous, you will not be getting in accidents anymore. So you're not going to need all this structure either. So I think you could create these really cool interiors for vehicles.
Sure. Well, I mean, go back to when General Motors had the Highwire concept, the 11-inch thick skateboard. So all the structure was in the 11-inch skateboard.
And the powertrain.
And the powertrain. And so all of the safety, right, mm-hmm. was there. And if you think about it, so we're having electric drives. We'd have pure steer-by-wire, so essentially you wouldn't need the rigid steering column. So they'd be able to, you know, so you could basically say, oh, let's get this out of the way and just like, put it over there if we're not using it now, and then maybe lean back and do it. But, yeah, there are those possibilities, and certainly you could have, you know, a variety of exotic cars. I mean, using, you know, technologies to do low-volume production. So you could have a different car, and you could have a different car, and I could have a different car. It wouldn't cost that much, right? I mean, because you'd be taking advantage of, you know, perhaps we'd be printing the car, right, with 3D printing.
Should be printing the car by that time.
It's quite a possibility, for sure.
Remember, the GM Firebird 3 had a joystick control, no steering wheel.
That's right. And even the vision back then on those cars was some sort of limited access highway
with
that would be sort of autonomous.
With guide wires
Correct.
In the pavement.
Right.
Yeah.
Because back then, even the futurists couldn't imagine something being totally wireless.
Right.
Had to have some sort of connection. But I find Nissan's announcement stunning. Stunning because up to now, everybody in the industry has said, oh, yeah, yeah, 2025 at the earliest, more like 2030, maybe beyond 2030. And Nissan's going, no, 2020, we're going to have multiple models available fully autonomous.
Put your order in now, Peter.
That's 6 years. I don't think
Peter's ever going to buy an autonomous car.
I don't think so.
So I read your column, and at 6 a.m. I turned on Morning Joe to see him.
Oh, good.
Just as you recommended, and they were in the Flat Rock plant. I understand you went over there today, John.
I did. The press conference after it, right?
Right, right. So what Gary's alluding to here is this very popular television show, or at least popular among some people, called The Morning Joe, all political discussion and whatnot, did their broadcast this morning from the Ford Flat Rock plant. Which was interesting because they kept promoting, we're going to Detroit, we're going to be broadcasting from Detroit. And
they never set foot in Detroit.
They never set foot in it. And, you know,
they shot the usual, the Packard plant and all the
well, they show all the destruction.
The ruins.
Yeah. Right. But I thought, you know, kudos to Ford PR for pulling this off.
Well,
to
yeah.
Get that show at their plant.
Yeah, I heard they worked 4 years in Gainet.
Wow.
No. 4 years?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
That wasn't substantiated. I heard it from two people, but it wasn't substantiated with Ford PR. It takes a long time to orchestrate that.
Yeah. Oh, I can believe it. And
because to pack up a show like that logistically is a huge undertaking. Yeah.
A nightmare. That's a lot of... I know from our video productions how much gear and people have got to go on the road. So for something like that, multiply it by 10.
Yeah,
I was a little confused about Ford's move about expanding the capacity of Fusion by 30%, and Fusion sales are only up by 13%.
I think they claimed 18 today. Maybe they were just going by July.
Well,
but here's what they said, Gary.
No, I mean it says according to them, Fusion sales up 13% in the U.S. this year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is from them. And then I started looking a little more carefully into the numbers for Fusion and the surging demand, as they call it. And apparently that surging demand is largely among fleets. So fleet sales for Fusion, 33% of the volume, which makes it number two to Impala.
Hmm.
So.
Now, what they have said, too, is that they're operating on very low day supply in some markets, like down to 20 days. So what they're arguing is the sales could be a whole lot higher if they had the production. But the other thing, then, remember, in the Hermosillo plant, where the main production for Fusion takes place, is also MKZ. So presumably, if MKZ sales are really taking off, they need extra Fusion production. So I'm trying to provide a logic here.
It is a little surprising to me, though. I mean the level to which that, you know, these are not retail sales, and the disparity between the volume, and you would just think that in terms of, you know, thinking about lean production operations, you wouldn't add that much capacity. It just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me, but.
They smell blood because, you know, the Fusion's retailing. So Ford says at like
$2,000 more than Camry?
Yeah, that was another thing. They're taking on Camry. So I checked the numbers through July. Camry sales, 242,406 cars. Accord sales, 218,367 cars. Fusion sales, 181,668. Well, you know, I could possibly be the tallest man in the room, but it doesn't seem likely.
Well, I don't think they're going to surpass Accord or Camry anytime
right.
soon. But the car is selling well, and it seems to be the transaction prices seem to be awfully good, too. So I don't know if they'll
but
sell this
30%. But about these fleets, so that offsets your
yeah,
proposition.
I know
money on it.
Everybody trashes fleets except for those who are selling cars
to
fleets. I don't think there's anything wrong with selling.
No, but I mean, but, you know, so on the one hand, yeah, you're selling a lot of, you know, titanium additions, right? But on the other hand, you're selling a lot of contractor white vehicles down here, which probably are not as loaded. So you got to think about that.
Another thing I picked up on is Volkswagen is getting very vocal about how there's no kinds of incentives for diesels in the U.S. market. They say, you know, if you want to buy an electric, you get a $7,500 tax credit, you know, or a plug-in. You get to drive in the HOV lanes in the cities that have that. But there's nothing for diesels. And, in fact, you know, the tax on diesels, federal tax, is higher than it is on gasoline, 6 cents higher. So they're like, hey, what's the deal here? You know, we can help the industry meet CAFE. We can cut CO2 by 30%. How come we don't get any love?
I think on the one hand, you know, when did auto diesel invent the diesel? And I mean, what?
I don't know, 120 years ago.
20 years ago, and so that technology is pretty well baked. And you know, if you go to Europe, what are, you know, half the people in their passenger cars driving around in? Diesels. So I mean, the technology is pretty well established. And I think that part of the reason why there's incentive for electric vehicles and for hybrid plug-ins and whatnot is because governments around the world pretty much want to incent the development of the technology. And so why would you incent the development of a technology that's already developed?
Well, but isn't that the wrong way to look at it? Shouldn't you be saying, hey, we want to get to this goal of X reduction in emissions, X improvement in fuel efficiency? Why should governments be saying, and we think you should be buying this, whereas if there's other technologies that can get you there that don't have the incentives, what's the logic in that?
So why would it necessarily be related to the motor vehicle and not related to the taxation on the fuel itself? So if the fuel itself...
Oh, remains, now you're talking logic, Gary.
Well, and the other thing is that recently the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute came out with a study and looked at the tremendous savings that people who have diesel cars have over, you know, not that long a time. I mean, like in 5 years, I mean, you're making money by having one of these things. I think that the problem is that the vehicle manufacturers that are offering diesel cars are not making a compelling argument to the market as to why this might be a superior way to go. And, you know, what was it that 2 or 3 months ago when we had the Chevy Cruze diesel engineer on the show? And, you know, I think we're going to begin to see, you know, a lot of pull from the market to get this technology. So maybe Volkswagen need not worry.
No, they probably don't need to worry. But I think they've got a legitimate beef here that the government is
picking
choosing
winners.
It's picking winners, right. Whereas what they're saying is, look, just set the target and let us figure out how to get there and let the market decide. And I think they've got a legitimate complaint here.
So it must be that their hybrid's not selling very well, huh?
It's not. That's absolutely true. But, you know, look, on the only hybrid that really sells well is the Prius, and mm-hmm. the Prius does fantastic. None of the other hybrids really come anywhere near those numbers.
You know, and as we speak, you know, we're talking about Nissan having the big 360 program, out in Southern California, Toyota is running the ginormous hybrid technology event in Ypsilanti this week. And I thought it was very interesting that one of the guys who is now the managing officer of Toyota Motor Corp was on the original Prius project. And so he gave a speech there. And I thought it was very interesting because I'd never heard this about the development of the Prius. And so this guy, I'm going to mangle his name, Satoshi Asigo, and he said, at the time we had, and this is for the original when they're doing the development, he goes, at the time we identified 80 different hybrid configurations that could be considered. We narrowed it down to the top 20, then ran them through simulations seeking overwhelming fuel efficiency and found four prime candidates. At this point, we could assess the degree of difficulty and cost. The clear winner was a series parallel hybrid design with fairly simple hardware of two motors and a planetary gear set, but highly complicated software. Despite the complexity and upfront investment in the software, increased volume would not mean increased cost. This would be the most viable system with an eye to the future. So basically, what it seems to me this guy's saying is that they were taking the Microsoft strategy. You spend a whole lot of money developing Windows, and every copy after the first one is a possibility for revenue. And I've never heard that in relation to any car.
I've not heard
that. It's the software that they thought, we'll just keep this really simple mechanical, but we'll really go to town on that. And it's just, you just wonder going forward, autonomous cars, what becomes, the possibility of scalability if software is what drives what we touch and feel and experience.
And it's happening, and it is. And you're right. Autonomous technology is, the sensors and all that, you got to make them talk to one another, and that's all the software.
Yeah. It's just
very
it's
interesting.
Amazing, yeah.
Great point. Hey, why don't we take a quick commercial break? Why don't we get to our guest, Jeff Luke, coming on the show. Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone who are now pushing the Firestone brand.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Well, we've got Jeff Luke, the chief engineer do I have that right? Because I know GM's changed some of the titles on you guys now.
Yeah, it's executive chief engineer for global trucks, full-size and mid-size and SUVs.
Oh, my gosh. Now, I remember back in the GMT 800 days, General Motors said, if you took that program and broke it off as a standalone company, it was like 22 on the Fortune 500. Do you guys still stand in that level?
Yeah, our truck platforms between the light-duty trucks like the Sierra and the Studio today and the Silverado and the heavy-duties and then the SUV lineup, the Tahoes, Suburbans, the Yukons, Yukon XLs, and the Escalades, all together, they're very profitable products.
That's got to be, what, a million units or something like that, all told?
Yeah, it's over a million units, all told. Yeah, we build in four plants, it's well over a million units.
Wow. And then what's the stat that I heard, too, that something, at least in the U.S., something like 40% of all pickups sold in the U.S. are over $40,000?
Yeah, looking at recent transaction prices here over the last probably 8 years, there's been a steady increase in transaction price. And, I think the performance goes along with it. There's more features, functions, capability, and, customers are expecting more, and it's our job to provide it.
You guys brought a new high trim level to this vehicle for the first
time. We did, yeah. In the new lineup for 2014, in the Chevrolet brand, we brought in the High Country, which is a trim and performance level above the LTZ. And in the GMC lineup, the Denali is the premium truck level there.
So what was it that people were looking for? What were some of the things that you put in the...
I think they look for their materials. They want premium materials, whether it's the leathers and the seating, the stitching. You know, they also like colors to go with that, too, a unique color. You know, like performance features, up-level engine capability. You know, generally you see this, they like specific badging. Goes along with that to identify this and a look. You know, you got to generally on these types of vehicles, you get a really unique front end appearance and unique wheels generally go with these types of packages as well.
This program must have been started about the time GM was going into bankruptcy, right? Or had it started before? Did the bankruptcy really slow this program down or no?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it slowed it down. We had a lot of internal discussions about, okay, you know, what is it we are going to go about executing in here? And, you know, even during some of those toughest times, I can remember them very well. You know, we talked a lot about made the absolutely the correct decision was to redo the whole body structure on the truck, where we've you know, put the doors into the body side and triple sealed them, and now this truck is extremely quiet and refined. And you know, it was one of those discussions we had right during the, you know, those times in those bankruptcy hours, and you know, we did the right thing, had the right thing for the customer and the product.
So it's all new, right?
Well, certainly the cab is all new, and you know, the styling is all new. There's only a handful of engine-related parts that are actually carryover with this Ecotec 3 powertrain that
fastener.
We have. Yeah, bag full of fasteners. our architecture of our chassis, our frame system, is the hydroformed chassis, which you know, we have continued to improve over the years. But it's proven, tried, and true, and so we've done that. The interior is all new, seats, IP, the infotainment system, all new. We've added tilt and telescopic columns, for example, for customers to position themselves even more comfortably in the seats.
I love telescopic steering, man. I got to tell you, that is so good. The other thing that I've noticed about both trucks, the Silverado and the Sierra, I've spent time in both of them, is... it's the 100-yard test. You know, within 100 yards, you can tell, wow, this is so much stiffer structure than the prior truck, which was no slouch. It was no wet noodle either.
Yeah.
And the other thing is how much quieter this new truck is, too. You must have spent a lot of time on those two things especially.
We did. That was one of the goals that we really wanted to do, was focus on refinement and quietness in the truck. And as I mentioned, the door system is just one of those aspects. But as you guys know, it's, you know, it's about reduce, block, and absorb. And we've turned the dials significantly in each of those areas. And when you get in the truck, I think even when you get in the first time and you close the door, and just the nice thud you hear, and then you can sit in there and it's very quiet even before you start up the engine and become and get driving. And it's, you can just tell right off the bat.
And it's direct injection, and even with the hood open, it's got to be one of the quietest direct injection engines I've ever run across.
Yeah, the SIDI system on the vehicle, you know, pressures of 2,100 psi or so in order to get the effectiveness of the direct injection there. We wanted to make sure that we focused on that, and so the intake manifold cover is an acoustic cover to help you know, block any noise. And as you say, it is very quiet when you got the hood open, you're standing there. Often people have said I've heard people say they've been sitting in the vehicle, forgot it was running, and started it again because it's so quiet in the cabin, let alone standing outside.
Well, you know, talking about the structure that you guys put together for this vehicle, I was interested to discover that you got the first pickup trucks to get the 5-star overall vehicle score from NHTSA for its NCAP assessment. So there must be something to the safety of this vehicle.
Yeah, that, it's a great point. And, you know, we're really excited about the 5-star rating. You know, customers expect, you know, the highest of performance for safety. And it starts with the structure. But I also think a lot of these other features that are in this truck that are often in up-level luxury cars, like lane departure warning, forward collision alert, you know, even front park assist now are on these trucks. And it just helps people with control and parking. And, you know, as you're indicating, when you do get into a situation where there's an accident, you know, having a 5-star rating and performance is, you know,
it's comforting, it's, if nothing else, right?
Place to be. Place to be.
What I like is some of the little features that are so simple that when you see it, you go, this is such a no-brainer, but it works so well. And the one that's my favorite are the notches in the back bumper at the corners that double as a step up to be, and then you've contoured the stake holes at the top of the bed so you can grab onto that and pull yourself up. So that tells me you guys must be really listening to your customers to come up with things like that, or am I wrong? Or is it just
absolutely. And many of us who are just avid, passionate people who use these trucks every day, you know, we think about these things. And that one, you know, the bumper step with the handhold is, you know, as you say, very simple but effective. And, you know, you can pop yourself right in the back of that box and climb out just as easy. But the tailgate feature, you know, with the strut, the torque strut, you know, to release the handle and let the tailgate drop without having to expend any energy and half the effort putting it up, you know, we just think, you know, these are smart things to do. You know, the additional tie downs in the upper part of the box, you know, 250 pounds, 9 locations, and the lights, you know, many customers have tonneau covers or caps. And, you know, as you guys know, when you're out late at night or early in the morning, a lot of customers are, you know, hunters and fishermen, you know, have their stuff in the back and it's dark and, you know, you need to be able to see. And that having that light in there without having a flashlight in your mouth, you know, when you're trying to mess with your two hands there is just practical, I think.
You know, it's interesting, the tailgate, for example. I think that people who don't have experience with pickup trucks have no idea how heavy those things are.
Yeah.
And as you look at trucks that you're bringing to market that have such nice amenities, that you can imagine, you know, a lot of people who would never think about owning a truck, or smaller people that would, they just say, "Nah, what the heck, I'll just get a truck." And unless you have something like that system, I mean, they'd be knocked on their butts just mm-hmm. opening that tailgate. And so it's really, you know, a small thing, but amazing.
Yeah, that, I think, you know, we really try to focus on the details. And like I say to the team all the time, the difference between greatness and mediocrity is in attention to the details. And so we try to make sure we focus on the details all the time. It's those little things that really matter. It really is.
So what was the toughest thing about doing this program, if you look back on it?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I like to use the word balance. I don't like to use the word trade-off. I don't like to take something away at the expense of something else. And I think focusing on the performance and the fuel economy at the same time, you know, with these new trucks, we're able to increase the fuel economy on them while at the same time giving the customers more payload capability and more trailering capability, which is what these vehicles are designed to do. And so if you can do both, I think, you know, that's what we went out to do. And so that can be a challenging endeavor because often when you try to do one, you know, the other can be, you know, potentially a trade-off there. But I don't believe in that. And you know, we focused on doing both. So that's why you see the numbers as they are, you know, better fuel economy and better payload and better trailering.
That was one of the tougher things, trying to get that balance then.
Getting both.
So in your career with General Motors, you've been with trucks the whole time in one way.
Predominantly, yes. I started in 1986. I went to Kettering GMI at the time and had a great co-op experience and worked in large vans at the time and then moved to trucks and worked in trucks and manufacturing and then came to engineering. And I spent a couple of years working on the Buick LaCrosse program when we launched it, right in around the bankruptcy times, and then came back to trucks and have worked on trucks ever since.
So if you look back over this period of time, and so both in terms of process of getting these things out as well as the product and the technologies that go in them, you know, what do you see as the difference between then and now? What are some of the main points that you've witnessed?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think certainly the technology in which we go about doing the designing and the engineering has dramatically changed, you know, in this period of time. We were talking a little bit earlier about the computer-based analysis equipment that and systems that are available. And, you know, you can turn designs around and analyze them today, you know, unbelievably quicker than you could back then. And the reliance on hardware, for example, to prove out designs is much, much reduced today versus, you know, in those times. So efficiency and speed has really changed when it comes to product development, I'd say, in the cycles of learning.
Does that help you from a management standpoint of a program? Because, you know, listen to what you're talking about. All these different technologies coming in the powertrain, in the infotainment systems. I know even in the basic steels that you're using. And how do you manage all this complexity? And does all this computer simulation make it easier? Or just because now all your engineers can run far more iterations than ever in the past, does it make it more complicated?
I think so. I think, you know, managing complexity, you hit the nail on the head, is the challenge in this business. As you can imagine with these vehicles, you know, they're designed to provide solutions from a fleet and customer perspective all the way to a person that, you know, uses the truck for, you know, pulling his or her boat, for example, on the weekend. And so there's so many possibilities of things you can do, but you have to make sure you're focused. And so being able to define the requirements and make sure then that the team is focused on executing those in a way in which you utilize your capital in the most effective way is what we try to do. And that's one of the things that I think about every day as well in my job, other than making sure it's engineered with excellence.
We've seen Ford do really well with its turbocharged V6. You chose not to counter them with a turbo on this truck. Why not?
Well, we watched very closely, and that powertrain in the Ford lineup seems to be working well for them. We looked at it and said, well, you know, our pushrod engine has been a tried and true technology, but we wanted to take it to the next level and direct inject it like we talked. Expand our active fuel management and also variable valve time it. And we believe that in all conditions, from lightly loaded through trailering versus that technology, that you know, this is a better solution for our customers. And so we're really happy with it, and you know, it performs really well.
And it's not like General Motors doesn't have that technology in its portfolio. I had the opportunity to drive the XTS V-Sport this week with the twin turbo, 410 horsepower, and boy, that was a lot of fun. So,
yeah,
you guys know how to do it.
But your customers weren't saying, "Hey, we want your version of EcoBoost engine."
No, I don't get a lot of customer feedback specifically saying that. Maybe some of the early events when we're talking to our dealers, there were some questions about it because, you know, Ford has, you know, advertised their configuration, and they've sold, you know, it's a fair percentage, I believe, of their build. And and so there's questions about, okay, what strategy were we taking? And when we explained it, what the virtues were and how it would perform, it was pretty quick to see that, you know, it's been well received.
So you're getting good fuel economy numbers out of the six.
Yeah, the V6 engine is an all-new engine as well. It's the same displacement as the prior V6, but the technology difference is night and day. It also has the three technologies, the SIDI and the active fuel management and the variable valve timing, and the fuel economy on the V6 is outstanding when you just drive it around, you know, and you're watching your DIC there, watching the V6 go into four-cylinder mode. Is really an amazing thing, and the V8. In fact, our higher displacement V8, the 6.2 liter engine, has so much torque reserve with its capability that it holds the four cylinder mode a lot. And in fact, I'm driving one today, and it's amazing how long you can actually travel in the V4 mode to conserve fuel when you need it, when you're pulling or towing something like that. It you know, you got all the V8 capability, but when you're in lightly loaded conditions and at relatively higher highway speeds, it's remarkable how much time you spend in V4 mode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can verify what you're saying because I don't know, a few weeks ago the Chevy PR people dropped off the old truck and the new truck.
Oh yeah,
so I could go back to back. And I got 25% better fuel economy in the new truck. And that was with more city driving than I was getting in driving the old truck. So it could have even gone higher than that. And that's pretty impressive. That's a big percentage. I mean, it's only a few miles per gallon, you know, if you look at it that way. But on a percentage basis, it was a very impressive gain.
Ran into a fellow at work today who has relatives who live in Louisiana, and he happened to mention that they just bought a new Silverado. They're long-time truck buyers, and the first thing he said was their first comment was how the fuel economy was very, very much noticeable, about how much improved it was, and they were very happy with it. So, you know, I listen closely to these comments and, you know, make sure, because, you know, at the end of the day, it is the promise.
Well, I'll tell you, if I had the previous generation Silverado and I got into the new one, my reaction would have nothing to do with the fuel economy. My reaction would have to do with the interior of the new one is so far advanced from that last generation car.
I mean, I just like the last generation.
Oh, I just think it's a breathtaking. I think it's so much nicer now.
The old one to me was almost more Mercedes-like from a style standpoint. This is much more of a truck IP.
But the materials in this thing compared to those, I mean, this night and day. I mean, the guys did a great job on this one.
I think that's one of the other areas that, you know, we really wanted to focus on was the interior and really upgrading it, the materials, the comfort, the seats, the look, the connectivity, the position of the driver and the passenger. In the crew cab, you know, we basically redesigned it so that the B pillar was moved forward in vehicle. And so now the rear door is a little bit larger than the older vehicle, the last vehicle. The front door is a little bit smaller. But getting in and out of the back, it gives you 4 more inches of foot swing as you're getting in, which is huge, getting in and out of the crew cab, and 2 more inches of legroom in the back of the crew cab. So, you know, it directly relates to customer comfort.
We've seen Ram announce that they're going to put a diesel in their light-duty one. Mm-hmm. And Ford announced it's going to do a compressed natural gas F-150. What are your thoughts along those lines?
Yeah, let's look at both of those applications. I'm a big CNG supporter there. We have CNG in our heavy-duty trucks today. And certainly on light-duty, I think CNG is the way of the future.
How about LPG, propane?
Well, that's also another one that... I'm looking at closely as well, especially in Michigan. There's a big group of LPG users, and I think what the challenge is going to be that, you know, with engine technology as it develops, ensuring that diversity of fuel usage can be maintained direct injected engines operate a little bit different than port fueled injected engines with these types of gases. And so I'm very much involved in technology development in these areas.
Would you see a possibility of having an engine that would run both on gasoline and on
CNG?
CNG or
oh, yeah.
That you
yes.
basically is
yep.
deplete one and the other one kicks
yep.
in?
Yep, and it switches seamlessly. Or the customer can switch it, too. If you don't want to run on one, you can press the button but to change it over. But I do see that way. In fact, you know, I think the big anxiety today as far as really pushing CNG or LPG is just the availability of it. You know, it's just not readily available. The fleet customers can have, you know, stations at their fueling yards and things like that. They may be able to have the what we call monofuel type vehicles. But I think the regular customer has that anxiety and would rather have a bi-fuel type vehicle,
right?
You know, because they're just concerned that, you know, if they can't get the CNG or LPG because it's not readily available, then they're out of luck, you know.
Yeah, I ask about propane because we just shot a show that for my TV show that hasn't run yet. The city of Flint, just to use one example, has converted 70 trucks to propane. Mm-hmm. They're paying $1.14 a gallon.
Yeah,
I mean, this pays for itself
just like,
very quickly.
Yeah. Yep. Well, you know, one of the jobs I had before I started General Motors, I worked at a gas station, and it had a big propane tank, and that was one of the jobs that you know I had was to fill cylinders, and at that time buses and trucks and things like that. So ever since that time, I became fascinated as a fuel, and I think you know, in the future that does have a very prominent place, especially because it's you know our country is blessed with having abundance of this type of fuel. You know, the dependence on foreign oil, for example, is you know, the threat of not being able to have foreign oil availability with this type of a fueling source, I think is has a lot of possibility.
And presumably, given the size of a pickup truck, that being able to accommodate two fuel tanks would not be as much of an issue as it would be in a Malibu. I mean, it's
yeah, that's very true. In fact, just even this week, I've been in meetings with the team on how to configure tanks and how we want to handle this stuff. So yeah, it's very exciting, very exciting,
very interesting
part of the business. In fact, you know, when you look overseas, for example. The mid-sized truck that we have in Thailand, for example, the Colorado there, the Thailand market is very much diesel, but the government there incents the CNG. It's equivalent like 8 cents a gallon.
Better than a Volkswagen.
Yeah. So over there, for example, there are companies who are basically converting diesel engines to run on both diesel and CNG. So
wow.
It's really an interesting. Interesting dynamics worldwide in this area, and so it's I give a lot of thought to this stuff every day.
Very interesting. Hey, let's take another break because we want to get to all the questions that have been pouring in here. So, Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Hyundai.
What's my type? Well, they have to be smart, a good sense of direction, good taste in music. And, of course, good looks with nice curves. That gets my temperature rising every time we touch. And that exotic name, Elantra. Wait, are we talking about cars?
Okay, it's time for the rapid fire part of the show. Ben, let's let that rip. Okay, we got a bunch of questions here for you, Jeff. Eric Ambrose wants to know, everybody wants to lose weight, but for a truck, the lighter you go, you start losing towing and pulling capacity. How much should a truck weigh?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think in some areas of the truck, you can take mass out and not affect performance. You look at even in some cases can help you with additional payload capability that, you know, that it balances each other off. So, you know, I think that, you know, as you set the performance targets for the truck, it's important to know what the durability is. In a lot of cases, especially like with the box, it's important to with the loading and types of materials that go in there, that you design it such a way that, you know, it's not going to not be durable or reliable, that you don't have cracks. And so you've got to make sure your metal thicknesses are right, and, you know, you've got to have to choose wisely.
Mike DeWhite wants to know, is there a regular cab version of the truck?
Yes, there is a regular cab version of the truck with a 6.5-foot bed or an 8-foot bed.
Yeah, because none of the ads, the brochures, I can see why he's asking about it.
Yeah, no,
you're really emphasizing the crew cab.
Where the money is.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, where the market's going.
Yeah, and the market's going. About 60% of the market we see is crew cab body style, and next would be the double cab and then the regular cab. But still very important is the regular cab. And in the cadence of our launch as we progress, the crew cab was the third one that we launched, crew cab being the first.
And
what are the other percentages for the other two body types?
I think the double cab is probably running about 25%, and the regular cab maybe 15% or so.
So the market really has moved all to crew cab in a big way.
Yep.
Very interesting.
So what's this truck weigh sitting here? About
this truck's probably
5,900 pounds?
Yeah, maybe 58, 59. Yeah,
it's a
four-wheel
truck.
Four-wheel drive. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
And it's so cool to have this in the studio.
Yeah. This one is got the 5'8" box on it, and new for this 2014 model is also on a crew cab. You could get the 6.5-foot bed.
Scott in Cleveland wants to know that HD version. When's that out?
Yeah, that'll be coming soon. I'd say early next year.
Hey, we've got some phone calls coming in here, Ben. Let's get to the first one.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. A few weeks ago on Autoline Daily, you reported that GM and Ford are both starting to dabble in the medium to heavy-duty trucks again in markets outside of North America. Do you think there's any chance that GM or Ford would move to acquire Navistar to get back into this class of vehicle in North America? I think the current president or CEO of Navistar is a GM alumnus, too. Thanks.
Interesting question. Yeah, he's talking about Troy Clark,
yep,
who is now running Navistar.
Yep. Former colleague Troy and another former colleague, Denny Mooney, also works at Navistar and know both. And, you know, we're constantly exploring opportunities, I would say, and with the Navistar folks. I've been in a couple of meetings over the past couple of years, and We'll see what happens.
And what he's referring to, as well as what we reported on Autoline Daily, is that GM and Ford both are in the big semi market in China, both, and I want to say Ford in Brazil. And here's two companies that got out of that market, and so what's I don't know if you're the right one to ask on this, Jeff. What's the move back into these big trucks about?
Well, if you look at the big truck segment there, it is growing. You know, a lot of customers have kept their vehicles for a long time, and are getting ready to, you know, their useful life is about to run out. And those trucks do last a long time, but, you know, the numbers, if you look at those segments, are growing. You know, there's good opportunity in those segments.
Wright Knight says, let me see, this is a little bit long. Being that the new V6 in the GM trucks is still 4.3 liters, will there be a new 5.7-liter V8 in GM's future using that new 4.3's bore and stroke?
Probably not. That's a good question, though. You know, the 4.3 was derived from the 5.7 originally, and we'll probably stick with the 5.3 as our high volume of V8 engine there. It's been very well received.
He also goes on to say, will GM pull that 4.5-liter diesel off the shelf and use it in a half-ton pickup?
That's a good question. We're considering our options.
Because that was a great engine.
Yes, it was. It was a very, very, very good engine.
And, of course, I mentioned that before. Ram's putting a diesel 3-liter V6 turbo, isn't it?
3-liter Viamatori.
Yeah. Yep. So I'm sure you guys are going to be keeping a close eye on that sells.
Oh, yeah. We'll keep a close eye on a lot of my daily reading is understanding what the customers want and what the competitors are doing.
At Bama Theo on Twitter wrote in to say, why didn't the new Silverado increase its weight advantage over the competition? And he wants to know, what's the weight advantage of the 14 versus the 2013?
Yeah, the versus a comparably equipped F-150, for example, we're probably 300 pounds, 350 pounds lighter, comparably equipped today. Ram, we're similar, I'd say. Versus today's truck, similar, maybe a little bit lighter. But it's not dramatically lighter. There's much more content on the new truck versus the old truck.
So is there a greater content of high-strength steel in the structure of this?
Yeah, the structure of this truck has got, maybe 35 to 40% more higher-strength steels on it than the prior truck.
That's how you get that 5-star rating, too, right?
So it was a contributor.
Hey, here's a good one. I want to know the answer to this, too. S10 Baja says, what is GM going to do about a Ford Raptor competitor?
Yeah, well, that's a great question as well. Just to say that that's one of the models that we are looking at potentially doing here. Customer base for that is, it's a performance type variant, and one of the things that we're considering.
Don Braun from Owensboro, Kentucky wants to know this, and I think this is a good question too. Why did the stylist go for a look that's similar to the last truck?
Yeah, I've got a lot of questions about that when we unveiled the especially the Silverado, the Sierra. Was considered to be very much different than the former Sierra, but the Silverado, not that much difference. When you put the two side by side, however, they are pretty significantly different. There's a heritage element in there, I guess is my point. And, Chevrolet Silverado trucks have been generally known for stacked headlights, a dual port grille. And so that's the heritage. But when you put the old Silverado beside the new Silverado, it's pretty significantly different.
But you got to put them side by side. That's what I like about the Sierra. I can tell 100 yards away coming down the road, that's the new one.
Yep. You exactly like you said. And I think a lot of it has to do with the headlights on the Silverado. You got the LED DRL signatures there, and that really pops out. You can tell that coming from 100 yards away anyways.
Hey, we've got another phone call coming in here. Ben, let's bring that in.
Hi, it's Travis Whiteside calling from Canada. Just went on a brand new dress. Got myself a brand new 1-ton dually GMC and just went out with some friends for our horse cutting thing we do. And had a Dodge and a Ford go with us. We were all pulling living quarters with four horse hangle all trailers. We're probably on the downhill side of about 28,000 pounds. And I got two buddies that are going to be looking at brand new Chevys when they're done. Ford's cooked the brakes out of them. The Dodge was, again, just without that engine deceleration was just brutal. But why do we allow Dodge to just keep marketing this way with this 30,000 pound pulling and all that kind of stuff? It's just craziness. Like, is this true what they're doing over there, or what's the deal? Thanks.
Yeah, it's a good question. From what I understand on this the Ram vehicle, I haven't had a chance to actually look at it yet. I'm waiting for one to be available to look at it with the very high rating, to understand the components being used there. I'm not sure, but it's only my speculation that it's perhaps using some 45 series type componentry in order to be able to beef up the frame in the axle, for example, to handle that kind of loading. It's my speculation, and I'm waiting to be able to drive it just to see how it is. Part of my job is to make sure I benchmark my competitors, and this is a truck that I'm very interested in looking at.
So to make a heavy-duty version of something like this, I mean, you have to have bigger gears inside and
yeah, it's thicker. You know, the frame, it starts from the frame. You know, the frame sections are much larger. The axle is a much bigger ring gear, and tubes are much larger, and so the tires have of greater rating, and you know, everything has to be designed and upsized in order for these types of loadings. You know, you look at a dually type payload at, 7,000 pounds or greater, it's a lot of payload in a box, you know, so you got to make sure that the structure handles that. And then when you put a trailer on the back, you know, you get vehicles that are, you know, you got to make sure that a person driving them can control them. And like the question was, when you talk about, exhaust braking, for example, which is an integrated feature there to add control to customer with all this weight, you know, you have to have these features.
We've got time for a couple of questions here. The Griffin says, why no Trailblazer in North America? It looks fantastic, it's the right size, and surely, even if you only sell a couple of thousand a month, it would be the highest volume variant of the Colorado platform. And, he goes on to say, I have to think 4,000's possible.
It's a good, it's a good question.
Now explain what the Trailblazer is.
The Trailblazer is the...
Because here, people are going to think it's an SUV, right?
Yeah, and well, actually, I mentioned the truck in Thailand, the pickup Colorado in Thailand, and we build it there, and we also build the Colorado in Brazil. So we have two plants to build the Colorado there. There's also a derivative of that truck that is an SUV that is called the Trailblazer. And it's a three-row vehicle. It's similar proportion and size as the Traverse. And it, however, is a full-framed vehicle. We again, like I mentioned, build it in Thailand for the market in Thailand. We export it right-hand drive to Australia, for example, send it to Russia. It sells in Russia, and it sells in Brazil. And so we export it basically all around the world. The reason why we're not bringing it here to the U.S. or Canada at this point is, you know, the SUV showroom, the Chevrolet SUV showroom, has got the Traverse, which is essentially that similar size and configuration, three-row passenger. And so between the Traverse and the Tahoe, you know, that's we think we have the bases covered.
Okay, last question. This is from Alexander, I hope I say this right, Karabitsis. He says, I'm currently starting high school, but I'm thinking I want to become an engineer in the auto industry. What advice can you give me to get to your position?
Well, what I would... I advise that what would be great for him is to apply to a school that has got a co-op program. Obviously, I went to GMI, now Kettering University. I would advise him to look there first.
Why the co-op prior to part?
Well, because I believe I gained so much real-world experience while I was on the semesters I was working, and then I went to school to learn the theoretical part of becoming a mechanical engineer. And I think, was just so beneficial. It allowed me to be able to determine for sure with these assignments I got that this was exactly what I wanted to do. And it didn't take me long with these experiences to be able to determine that. And, you know, to this day, I'd do the same thing all over again if I could.
Well, that's great. Jeff Luke, thanks so much for coming on After Hours with us.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Yeah. Peter, good seeing you.
Good seeing you.
As always, remember, you can always find everything at autoextremist.com that Peter's writing about. Or you can even follow him on Twitter at Peter M. DeLorenzo.
Yep.
And Gary Vasilash, you can get all his things at...
Autofieldguide.com.
Autofieldguide.com. And great having you here
Thank you, John. Peter.
And thanks for having tuned in this week, folks, and join us again here next week.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
and by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.